This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. We appreciate you joining us. We're here to discuss the important events of this past week with our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Greetings.
We're going to start by talking about the horrors in Syria that will likely provoke military action from the West. For this, we'll turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent.
So Mr. Assad, the president of Syria, has done it again. He has used chemical weapons on his own people. This happened on the evening of April 7th, and it happened in a region just to the east, or just on the outskirts of Damascus to the east. This is a rebel enclave. They've been there for over 5 years, and while Assad's men have been successful of late, obviously not as quick as they wanted to be at routing or removing these rebels, and so he decided to use chlorine as well as some nerve agent. It looks like right now, with that information still coming in, there were 40 to 70 people that were killed. We've still got different reports, up to 500 people wounded from this, women and children being the main people that on the receiving end of this, as obviously these are women and children belonging to the rebels, or at least according to them. And so this has really inflamed the West. Mr. Trump, the United States president, was very quick to rattle off numerous tweets about this attack, indicating that an attack, a reprisal attack, was imminent against Assad or the Iranians, or maybe even the Russians. We're not sure exactly. Nothing has happened of yet, but right now the world is waiting for a response to this chemical weapons attack.
Chemical weapons, this has really been, this was the red line that the Obama administration spoke about. This is what provoked Donald Trump sending those missiles earlier in his presidency when he saw the results of that chemical attack that Assad waged earlier. What's interesting is how brazen Assad is in using these weapons. And of course, it's only occasionally where you have something that gets this much press, where you see these kinds of images like we've seen in this one that tend to raise the ire of Western nations. But this is actually something that Assad is doing quite routinely, isn't it?
Yeah, I think this one was drew more of attention just because of the footage that came out about it. But it has seemed in the past year that there has been other chlorine attacks. This one in particular is interesting just because it happened on the anniversary of the April 7th Tomahawk cruise missiles that were fired by the United States from the Mediterranean against Assad. And here we are 1 year later to the exact day, and Assad is deciding to use chemical weapons again, in a way kind of it looks to be showing the United States that had no deterring effect whatsoever. I remember talking about this a year ago with you, and we were kind of surprised by the United States' response since it had been so lacking for so many years. And we were asking the question, will this be a trend in the future that we're going to see a mm-hmm. more robust response in the Syrian civil war by Donald Trump? That didn't happen. Mm-hmm. And the fact that he would do this attack that was kind of uncalled for, really, he was give it another couple of months and he probably would have routed these rebels from this region. It kind of shows that he is not deterred. He's not scared to continue to use chemical weapons. And of course, chemical weapons for him have been a hugely successful method of defeating the rebels, instilling fear in the rebels. Case in point, a couple days after this attack, the rebels agreed, we're out of here. You can have this region. We just give a safe passage to the north out of here, and we will leave this Damascus suburb. And so it was effective. And right now, hasn't been much response as yet.
The New Statesman reports, since they were first deployed in the war in December 2012, the Syrian Network for Human Rights has documented 213 subsequent uses of chemical weapons. So that's about three a month over the last six, 7 years. It says Assad has simply not eroded what academics call the chemical weapons taboo. He has shattered it, using chemical weapons to the point where it's kind of routine. And even though it's only the occasional attack that warrants this type of coverage, it's happening quite a lot. So as you said, this is a man who's very confident. It wasn't but a week or two ago when Donald Trump was talking about, well, the United States needs to pull out of Syria. Suddenly, like, he's really wanting to kind of wash his hands of this situation, or at least to declare some brand of mission accomplished. And this action by Assad kind of just draws the whole scenario right back to the forefront.
Yeah, you would think that Assad would look at the speeches of Mr. Trump the previous week, saying we're about to draw down our forces in Syria, and just rejoicing and saying, let's just keep quiet for a while and maybe the Americans will be gone. Yep. And this type of action, kind of as you said, brought out a response from Mr. Trump that was even surprising. One of his tweets said this. This was after they kind of indicated that there was going to be some action, and Russia said that they were going, if America does try anything, they're going to shoot anything America sends out of the sky. And then he tweeted this on April 11th. This is Mr. Trump. Russia vows to shoot down any and all missiles fired at Syria. Get ready, Russia, because they will be coming. Nice and new and, in quotes, smart. You shouldn't be partners with a gas-killing animal who kills his people and enjoys it. And we are used to different type of rhetoric from this world leader than we don't see from others. But that was even one-upping himself, saying, get ready, Russia, they're coming. Now, there has been over the last couple of days a little bit of tempering to some of the speech of Mr. Trump, saying, I didn't say when this was going to happen. It'll happen, but I don't know exactly when it will happen. Nevertheless, it seems to have provoked Mr. Trump to stay involved in Syria, at least for a little while longer.
Well, you do wonder, with John Bolton now being the national security advisor, who is much more closely aligned with the way that Donald Trump has been talking for quite some time. And there seems to be a pretty concerted effort or attention focused on checking Iranian power, which was quite a departure from Mr. Trump's predecessor. You wonder whether that might play a role in the way that this this situation is handled going forward, basically using Assad's actions as a means of inserting themselves in here and dividing that alliance between Syria and Iran.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting, just because we know that Mr. Trump has to do more than what he did a year ago. Obviously, that didn't work. A targeted strike didn't work. So are you going to decide then to hit at the allies of the Assad regime, most notably Iran? Like you said, they've wanted to push back Iran. Even Israel had an attack this week on the T4 base, Iranian base, killing about 9 Iranians. And so Israel used as a pretext to attack Iranians. Is the U.S. planning to do something like this more against Iranian interests? I think that is likely, just because it's because of Iranian backing that Assad is still in power. While Mr. Trump's tweets have been focused on Russia, Russia doesn't desire any type of greater American presence in Syria to its detriment. It would not have liked this attack. Mm-hmm. I don't believe. I think Assad was probably acting on his own in this. Russia wants to keep the status quo. They've already showed themselves to be the force in Syria, the dominant force for the future. Let's just keep it the way it is. We've got our air base. We've got our, you know, secured our naval port. And so this kind of jeopardizes that. So I think the United States, knowing that Russia isn't wanting a greater confrontation, might look to this as a way of targeting Iran, as you said. And even the other partners of the United States in this would be looking for that as well. We have the United Kingdom and France being far more interested in attacking, it seems, because of this chemical weapons attack than they have in the past. They're willing to go all in. They're willing to support Trump with their own airplanes in this. And so are they taking more time to come up with a larger response that is directed at the Iranians? That's certainly a possibility.
Richard, what's your view of France's skin in this game? It seems to be among the more hawkish foreign powers looking at this situation.
Yeah, you definitely see an interesting shift in terms of getting involved in the Middle East away from Britain and towards France. France definitely does come across as the more enthusiastic of the two. They have been involved more in Syria, largely because of they've had those terrorist attacks from the Islamic State, like the major Bataclan attack a couple of years ago. And then when it came to Donald Trump getting allies involved, the first country he called was France. And that caused quite a stir over here in the UK, because we're kind of, that's basically our entire foreign policy, is to be America's best friend, America's most reliable ally, the first port of call when they want something taken care of, or an ally in a fight. They set out of the Iraq war and they kind of had more of a step back when it came to things going on in the Middle East. But before, when intervention in Syria was on the table under Barack Obama several years ago, Britain made a complete pig's ear of the whole situation and made an absolute mess and contributed majorly to the fact that nothing was done about Assad's use of chemical weapons back then. And so you're seeing leadership and just even ownership of what's going on in the Middle East shifting from Britain to Europe. And right now, Europe means France for the most part in terms of taking the most visible lead there. Germany has said they will provide support, but they won't take military action themselves. I think for France, it's much easier in terms of historical baggage, for France to take the lead. And I think Germany is quite happy to let France take the lead and take the costs when they're willing to. But you're seeing that shift in leadership and it being more Europe, mainland Europe and France and the European Union that's doing stuff in the Middle East rather than Britain.
Yeah, I think Richard is completely right with that. France, especially with Syria, is taking the lead here. Their president has even set his own red lines last summer. He said, in terms of chemical weapons use, if they're used again, he said, when you set red lines, this is Macron, if you're unable to enforce them, then you decide to be weak. Such is not my choice. And so he said that if this happens again, he's got to go in. And so there was an article in Foreign Policy this week that said that even if they have to act unilaterally, Macron should do it. The French should act unilaterally, even if the United States isn't going to act in this case. And its conclusion of that piece basically said Syria is an existential threat to Europe. It's not to the United States. And it's about time Europe got some skin in the game, is what it's saying. And so will we see? I think France would be more than willing to send its jets over and to act here finally in a more robust manner, something that we have been waiting for, Europe to finally get involved in the Syrian crisis.
Well, that is interesting because I feel like this whole situation with Syria, this has dragged on far longer than any of us expected to. And it seems like in a lot of ways, the West has just really tried to ignore the problem, and it just can't, because this continues to create problem after problem. We've seen the refugee crisis that Europe has been suffering as a result of what Assad's been doing to his people, not to mention just the visceral impact of seeing human suffering on the scale of what has been happening down there. So looking at going back to what we've been saying about this since it began back in 2012, we've been talking about the overview of prophecy that shows us this rift occurring between Syria and Iran. Maybe Brent, you're talking about the possibility of the events that we're seeing right now actually leading to something closer to what we have been expecting to happen there. It seems like, we're talking about kind of an inevitable outcome, that it's just a matter of seeing how the specific events that occur there lead to that conclusion.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, we've tried to look at this for years to see when is Europe going to get involved. The Bible prophecy talks about, as you said, Syria falling out of Iran's orbit into favor with Europe. How is that going to happen? And so far, we haven't seen much response from Europe at all. Now, the French president has put his own credibility on the line here with this attack. He has to act, or else he's weak, as he words out of his own mouth. So at least now we might see some European action in Syria, something that the Bible does indicate would happen. And if people want to read about that, they can go ahead and go back to 2012 and read the article, How the Syrian Crisis Will End. When that piece was written, I'm sure our editor-in-chief didn't think that it would last this long, but it has. And yet we hold true to that analysis and that forecast that by the end of this civil war, we are going to have Syria out of favor with Iran, in favor with Europe. And this might be leading to that event.
We actually have that article right there on the front page of thetrumpet.com right now under the editor's picks. Very important article from Gerald Fleury, How the Syrian Crisis Will End. Go check that out. We appreciate that, Brent. We're going to move on now to what we could call our ongoing coverage of the rise in strongman leadership in the world, this in the European nation of Hungary. For this story, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, Hungary had a significant election this week, and I know... Yeah, I guess it's kind of easy to think, especially from the U.S., well, it's Hungary. It can't be that significant. It's some small country over in Eastern Europe. But this had really far-reaching consequences for all of Europe. Everyone was watching Europe because Hungary's leader, Viktor Orban, he was up for election, and he represents – he is the figurehead of a very different vision for Europe. And – he has been blazing a trail for now. There's a whole series of leaders that have kind of come up behind him for a very different Europe, for one that is more authoritarian, that gets rid of the left-wing restraints that you have on power, that focuses on, or that gets back to Europe's Christian heritage, leaders that are very much men of action, and that stand up firmly and aggressively to protect their country's interests. And many in Europe view this as disastrous, the end of the European project. It is against everything that kind of the transnational bureaucrats in Brussels stand for. And there was a lot of people were hoping that this election in Hungary would be the day that Orbán's vision for Europe was defeated. There were polls, or at least, you know, indications, previous elections that gave people hope that, okay, well, maybe Orban won't be defeated, but at least he's going to get a chunk taken out of him. He might kind of emerge with some wounds, you know, and this would have big implications for the rest of Europe. People would say, okay, well, his vision doesn't work. We have to do things a different way. And instead, the exact opposite happened. He came out of that election with a two-thirds majority, enough to change Hungary's constitution, more powerful than ever, more popular, well, maybe not more popular than he's ever been, but certainly very popular and overwhelmingly popular within Hungary. Some of his main opposition was to the right of him, not to the left. So his leadership or his vision for Europe was really vindicated in this election. And now... those same people that were hopeful for his defeat are worried that this will just spread this different style of European leader even further.
So you, out of everything that you mentioned, all of the specific policies and even his own personality that are bringing the populace of Hungary behind him and giving him such popularity, one of the things that you mentioned is his desire to defend the Christian heritage of Europe. And you have this article that you are working on that should be up on the Trumpet site soon, if it isn't already there, on this, just the fact that people are looking at him as kind of they're, like you said, they want this to be a marginalized view of Europe in the future. But you actually talk about the fact that many of these things, and particularly that defending of Catholic heritage, in Europe is really more of the model of the future based on what you see in Europe's past. Can you just talk about that?
Sure. Well, actually, the article that we've got in the works is by Josué Michels, our German-speaking writer. And there's a good reason why we're having him write that article. Viktor Orbán has a very strong following within Germany, within its Christian Social Union. There's a lot of people around that are looking to him as an example of how he should be followed, and especially within Germany, even though he and Angela Merkel have very harsh words for each other. He's frequently invited to talk in Bavaria there. So it's a model that stretches beyond his border. But yes, he has really, again, blazed a trail that others have followed, talking about or really emphasizing Europe's Christian heritage, because you're having this big influx of Islam. Well, what makes Europe different from all of these Muslims that are coming in? Well, it is that Christian heritage. He's talked about creating a Christian Hungary within a Christian Europe. He said, we have the right to decide that we don't want a large number of Muslims within Europe. And then he's been followed by others. We've had, Robert Fico in Slovakia. He's saying, I don't want to see a Muslim community in Slovakia, saying that his country is built on Christian traditions. You've had Poland, you've had leaders there talking about, well, we're working to create a Christian order. Even France this week is starting to move in this direction. And that is really significant because, you know, this is the, you know, France is Europe's secular capital. You know, Christmas is not a public holiday. It's a public holiday in Britain. We're not very religious, but Christmas is still a public holiday. Most people still get the day off, but it's not a government holiday in France because they're strictly secular. They've had this very strict separation of church and state, more so than anywhere in the world. And then this week, I think it was Monday, Emmanuel Macron, the French president that we've already heard a bit about, he talked about how relations between church and state have been damaged and that they need to repair them. They need to be repaired. He gave an unprecedented speech to French bishops. And he said, it's up to you as much as us to repair these damaged relations. And you know, Manuel Valls, a previous French prime minister, he said, well, secularism is secularism is France. The latest socialist party leader, he said secularism is the jewel in our crown. He's been very much criticized for this. But that's the way things are going in France. And you had I'm trying to remember his name now, the other French candidate, I think Philippe. He ended up not being able to run. He was kind of unseated by corruption scandals. But he tried to run against Macron on a very Catholic ticket. So even in the bastion of Europe's secularism, you're seeing this move now more and more towards Christianity. And you know, even Reuters, in their article on this subject, their main subhead was the role of Islam. And it's this influx of migrants and their very public display of their religion that's getting Europe looking to and talking about their roots more and more. And it's Christianity and Catholicism that in so many ways are those roots.
We have this article that we put in our January 2018 edition of The Trumpet called Introducing Europe's Eastern Strongmen. And in the context of this strongman trend that's happening around the world, but seeing this develop within Europe is particularly interesting because of the prophecies of what the Bible calls 10 kings that are going to arise in Europe. And when you see somebody of Orban's strength coming to power and cementing his power the way that he has, in a way that it seems, you know, it would be pretty difficult for someone to reverse that or to unseat him, that you're seeing these, what we're viewing this as really the pieces falling into place in fulfillment of that 10 kings prophecy.
Absolutely. This trend for strong leaders in Europe is right in line with that. And so you get people seeing that and saying, well, this is the end of the European Union. well, it may be the end of the European Union. It's not the end of this push towards a European superstate. The Bible says that that European state is going to be made up of these 10 strong leaders. And in that article, we made the point, when the Bible talks about kings, it talks about kings for a reason. They have those autocratic characteristics.
Yep.
Now, they still work together. I think they see that, well, if we're going to deal with these threats like radical Islam and mass immigration, we do need to work together. And
that would even suggest a certain amount of ideological alignment between these kings.
Right, absolutely. I mean, what they're opposed to the Brussels left-wing bureaucrats' vision for a secular, transnational, kind of pretty woolly socialist Europe. That vision they don't necessarily like. But if you have a union of like-minded leaders that have the same kind of vision, they have the same vision for the protecting Europe, defending Europe, they're already on board with that.
Yep.
There's things like the Visegrad Group and these groups where several of these leaders have started to form their own clubs that have this same vision for Europe. So you can see them completely, these 10, once you have these 10 kings in place, building that kind of union. And we see those leaders coming up and trends towards those leaders all throughout Europe.
Well, check out this article by Josue Michels on thetrumpet.com, Viktor Orban's re-election, Another King Secures His Reign. You can also see that January 2018 Trumpet Edition article introducing Europe's Eastern strongmen that gives more prophetic context for this very important trend that we're seeing unfold there. Thank you for that, Richard. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. Over now to Japan, and another military milestone crossed. For this, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
For the first time since World War II, Japan has activated a unit of Marines. This is a 1,500-man unit, so it's quite a sizable force, and it'll be capable of projecting power in the East China Sea and beyond. So this was announced on April 7th, and it's really significant because it is Japan's first amphibious combat unit since its defeat at the end of World War II, and also because amphibious forces are generally viewed as offensive instead of defensive. And, you know, Japan's post-war military, the SDF, or Self-Defense Force, is supposed to be strictly defensive. So that the fact that this is an offensive force makes this really remarkable news.
What motivated this dramatic change?
Well, Japan has a serious shortage of natural resources. And so its economy has almost always been, or at least since it's been an industrial power, it's been nearly totally dependent on commodity imports. Imports coming in from places like Southeast Asia and the Middle East, especially. So Japan has been terrified over the last few years to see China becoming much more militarily capable and more assertive and more aggressive in its desire to control the various shipping lanes in Asia. We see that in the South China Sea, but there are even efforts underway in the East China Sea and in other regions there. The Japanese know that if the Chinese Navy, the PLAN, were to block these lanes, it would seriously choke Japan's economy and it could destroy it. So really, for as long as Japan has been industrial, this need to import resources has been among its highest concerns and among its biggest vulnerabilities. It's really a big part of why Japan colonized China and Southeast Asia in the years before World War II. And even the attack on Pearl Harbor itself was largely because America had threatened to block shipments of oil to Japan. So Japan felt that they had to do whatever it took to keep that from happening. So all of that very recent history shows just how desperate and how unyielding Japan is about keeping commodity imports flowing into the country. And for more than 70 years now, Japan's relied on the United States for its security. But right now, America's security assurances are very much in doubt. It's clear to more and more onlookers that those assurances may not be worth much. The U.S. is unpredictable and unreliable. And meanwhile, it's clear that China not only is becoming very powerful, but unlike the U.S., China is eager and willing to use its military power. So all of these concerns, all of these kind of converging trends would have factored heavily into Japan's decision to activate this Marines unit.
And when you put this move in the context of what we've been watching from Japan and a trend that we've been following for quite some time, this militarization of of a nation that was really strongly limited with the constitution that was put in place after World War II from being able to build these kinds of forces. This is yet another stepping stone in its militarization.
Yes, this is a big step, and it's something that the Trumpet watches really carefully, in part because history shows that the Japanese military machine in times of conflict can be unusually brutal and fanatic and destructive. The tragic history of World War II shows that, as does the Russo-Japanese War, the invasion of Taiwan, the First Sino-Japanese War, and the list goes on. So it was really because of those dark chapters of history, and because of that unusual wartime fanaticism, that the Allied powers at the end of World War II forced Japan to renounce war and to become a pacifist nation. And so with that history in mind, it is really sobering to see Japan now moving steadily away from pacifism and remilitarizing. And then this trend is also very significant in terms of Bible prophecy. The Bible says that one of the main players in World War III will be a group of Asian nations called the Kings of the East. That's in Revelation 16:12. And Herbert W. Armstrong, the editor-in-chief of the Plain Truth News magazine, said that based on his understanding of Bible prophecy, he believed Japan would be part of that Kings of the East bloc. And if you look at Ezekiel 38, it does list an ancient name for Japan as being part of the end-time Asian bloc. So when we keep these scriptures in mind and Bible passages about just how destructive this final world war will be, then it really shows us why it's significant today to see Japan activating Marines for the first time and just returning to militarism in general.
Well, thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. Go check those articles out on thetrumpet.com. There's an article, Japan Commissions First Marine Unit Since World War II, and also our trend article, Why the Trumpet Watches Japan's March Toward Militarism, that will explain this in more detail. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Now to America, the expanding investigation into President Donald Trump. For this story, we will turn to Andrew Miller.
Now, on Tuesday, an FBI SWAT team raided the office, home, and hotel room of Michael Cohen, who is a personal lawyer for President Donald Trump. So this is obviously pretty big news. It's not every day you have the FBI raid the office of the lawyer for the President of the United States.
Yep.
And
this has never happened before.
Not that I can think of. I mean, the closest parallels I've heard brought up is like comparing it to like Nixon and Watergate, but even then I don't think there was anything quite the same as this. Definitely emerging as politically controversial. They were emerged that I guess it was Robert Mueller's investigation had kind of given the tip to the get the warrant for this, which is one of the more controversial aspects, is that Robert Mueller is a special prosecutor appointed to investigate the allegations that Trump colluded with the Russians. And there's no evidence that Michael Cohen had anything to do with that. They were actually, the raid was looking for a payment that he allegedly made before the election to a woman Donald Trump had, again, allegedly had an affair with 10 years ago. So they're looking for concrete evidence that that affair happened and that there maybe was some financial mismanagement and how that payment was handled, which is definitely outside the scope of what Robert Mueller's investigation was hired to do. And as they, a number of legal analysts have made, because of what you call like attorney-client privilege in the United States, for this to be legal, you would have had to have the signature of Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general in the Justice Department, in addition to the tip from the Mueller investigation. So you'd need approval from high-level people in both the FBI and the Justice Department. So it's definitely not just some rogue police officers raiding an office. This is coming from the very highest levels of America's two premier law enforcement agencies. Looking for evidence of wrongdoing on the part of the president. And I guess as far as questions of legality, they would have need probable cause that not Trump, but Michael Cohen had committed a crime. And We obviously don't have the documents as to whether they had probable cause or not. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't. I'm sure we'll find out at some point.
You'd have to assume that they had enough to, like you said, the level of approvals required for this type of a raid, you would hope that they had a lot to go on to make these kinds of an aggressive action.
Yeah, you would definitely hope, but coming right on the heels of the Nunes memo about how the Department of Justice wiretapped Trump's presidential campaign using like a field report compiled by a British spy was paid for by the Hillary Clinton campaign, that's definitely not the sort of thing that legally carries probable cause. So they use that fake document to initiate the Russian probe in the first place. And then after investigating the Russian probe for a year, they didn't find any Russian stuff. So they've switched to raiding the office looking for evidence of wrongdoing on past affairs Donald Trump may have had, which is probably an easier thing to find evidence for than Russian collusion, but not part of the original probe.
Right. Well, you know, you do have to, it seems like the credibility of these institutions has been severely compromised by the way that they've handled these matters over this past year. And it's hard not to look at all of this as a personal vendetta against this particular president when you're just looking at the information that has emerged from some of these FBI agents, the way that some of these individuals have been talking about this man and in very partisan ways, and looking, you know, at him individually as being, you know, beyond the pale and somebody that they cannot stand to see having the power that he does. Putting this in the context of what Gerald Fleury has said about this in the cover story of the new Trumpet edition, how we're seeing this exposed, as we were talking about on Wednesday's Trumpet Hour, in a way that we never would have had he not come to office.
Right. It's almost a order of magnitude more corruption than there was even a couple decades ago. I know I was looking back at some of what Mr. Fleury wrote back in 2001 during like the Bush-Gore court rulings, and he drew attention especially to he wrote an article called Justice in Our Evolving Constitution, and he drew attention especially to a prophecy in Micah where he writes, just how bad is our justice system today? Then he quotes Micah 3, verses 2 and 3. He says, who hate the good and love the evil, who pluck off the skin from them and their flesh from their bones, who eat the flesh of the people and flay their skin off from them. They break their bones and chop them in pieces as for the pot and as the flesh within the cauldron. And then he explains the verse saying that God is speaking figuratively and spiritually. Our justice system rips off people's skin, breaks their bones, tears their flesh, chops them into pieces, throws them into a pot and eats them. It's probably one of the most grisly metaphors in the Bible. And then a little further down, he says, but this is God's evaluation of our justice system.
Hmm.
And this is a good 17 years before a lot of like the more recent exposés that he talks about in the cover story of this latest Trumpet, about them hiring someone to dig up dirt on the president and then using unverified information illegally to get a tap on his campaign, looking for Russian connections that aren't there. They can't find any. They switch to raiding the office of his personal attorney, looking for pretty much anything they can get. I guess no word yet if they found anything, but it's definitely bending and in some case even breaking. Yeah,
the lawyer himself, it sounds like he's pretty nervous. He's pretty unhappy that at what they may have found there. So the chances are pretty high that this could lead to something that would really cause trouble for the president. Well, we do appreciate that, Andrew. If you want more information about that, I would really encourage you to look at Stephen Fleury's article on thetrumpet.com, Robert Mueller's Witch Hunt. He talked about this at length on Monday on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. I believe it was Monday. And Gerald Fleury's article, Saving America from the Radical Left Temporarily, a very important article that is now available online at thetrumpet.com. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we'll discuss collusion between Russia and Germany and between China and the Philippines. We'll also look at evidence of China's massive thievery of American technology. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Leaked information shows evidence of collusion between Russia and Germany in their energy market. For this story, we'll go back to Britain and hear from Richard Palmer.
Right. So I think you were talking about this the week I was sick, actually, a couple of weeks ago, with how the two of them, how Russia and Germany are working together in this Nord Stream 2 pipeline coming down through the Baltic. And there's been a leaked investigation by the European Commission where they were investigating Gazprom, the Russian part of this deal on Nord Stream and a whole load of other deals, and what accusations of them doing unfair and anti-competitive practices. Now, this European Commission is very keen and very quick to jump on American companies for all kinds of fairly flimsy excuses for anti-competitive practices. I mean, they're always quick to jump on Google, jump on Facebook, Starbucks even. I mean, some of those social media companies, that I think more and more is coming out to show some of that is certainly justified. But there is a very, with Europe, there is a very strong political agenda there. But with Gazprom, now with this leaked document, it makes it clear they know exactly what is happening in terms of very dodgy behavior, and they're going to do nothing about it. So the document, for example, it talks about how Poland has to pay about $350 per 1,000 cubic meters of gas. Germany, who's even further down the same pipeline, and with a longer pipeline, there comes more costs. So logically, you'd expect they'd have to pay more. They pay $200, dramatically less than Poland. Poland is accusing Germany of using its control of the EU to suppress the full findings of the inquiry, to push for a friendly settlement with Gazprom. They had one of their leading MEPs said the document shows beyond doubt that Gazprom has trespassed on EU law for years, and the Commission is about to issue a de facto acquittal anyway. But this is more than about unclear gas prices. Gas is a weapon for Russia. They've used this repeatedly to blackmail companies and countries into submission. There's the very naked and open, do what we say or you get no gas in the middle of winter. There's the more subtle, the more friendly your administration is to Russia, the cheaper your gas prices are. Mm-hmm. And for those of us in Europe, a lot of us, we have gas heating in our homes. We have gas cooking. This is a major bill that we pay every month. If you want to look good as a president, make everybody's lives better instantly by decreasing their costs every month, cozying up to Russia then has got to be pretty tempting. You can improve your economy instantly overnight.
Yeah.
So it's a major tool of Russia, and you can see this just proves beyond doubt that Germany is working with them in using that tool. And actually, it's been a major boon for Germany. I mean, they're exporting powerhouse powered by cheap gas from Russia, in part.
So anytime we see evidence of the cooperation between Germany and Russia, it raises a bit of a red flag, looked at from a historical perspective and from a prophetic perspective. Can you put it in context for us?
Yeah, exactly. From even just a historical perspective, it should raise red flags. It was Otto von Bismarck who said the secret of politics is make a good treaty with Russia. And you've seen this kind of cooperation throughout history. The two of them sit across each other on the great European plain. They have no natural barriers between each other. They're kind of stuck in this situation where they're either at each other's throat and don't really have good natural defenses against each other, or they work together. And they've kind of flipped between this relationship continually. You saw them going back to the late 18th century, getting together to divide up Prussia and Russia and Austria, to divide up Poland between them. And then 200 years or so later, in 1940, you see Germany and Russia doing exactly the same thing, dividing up Poland between them. Over this huge span of time, the same situations of the two of them working to divide up Europe. So, of course, Europe is really nervous watching this happen. And you look at Bible prophecies, and there are prophecies that indicate that these nations are going to cooperate. I mean, we talk mostly about it in terms of Germany and China, the two of them working together in an economic relationship. But the Bible certainly indicates that Russia would be a part of that as well. And Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry has pointed to this repeatedly in a Russia and China and Prophecy booklet. He wrote, every time just before, or every time competition between Russia and Germany heats up, they form a deal with one another just before going to war. Mr. Armstrong talked about this for a long time. So, I mean, we don't have a huge amount of time to go into all the details, but we have an article, The Russian Alliance You Really Have to Worry About, that goes over a lot of exactly that history. Warnings from just even writers and experts on foreign relations and historians to what the Bible says. And then that booklet, Russia and China and Prophecy, I just, you know, I can really point strongly to that as understanding this dynamic and Russia's rise in power especially, but this dynamic between Germany and Russia and how these are prophesied to work together.
Well, thank you very much for that, Richard. Definitely check that out, The Russian Alliance You Really Have to Worry About, on thetrumpet.com. China continues to expand its dominance of Asia at the expense of U.S. alliances. This week we saw more evidence of this with the Philippines. For this story, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte traveled to China on April 10th, and he met with China's paramount leader, Xi Jinping. The two of them signed a whole raft of agreements on economic cooperation, infrastructure projects, agricultural technology. They also signed a major deal for Filipinos to work in China as English teachers. And this visit resulted in about $9.5 billion worth of investment into the Philippines from Chinese companies. And then President Xi also promised to give the Philippines an additional 500 million renminbi, which is about $80 million for infrastructure, no strings attached, and for other economic assistance. During this trip, Duterte said that China and the Philippines have achieved what he called a higher level of friendship. And the two of them discussed expanding their joint offshore oil development projects in the South China Sea. They also signed a memorandum of understanding on China's Belt and Road Initiative, getting the Philippines more enthusiastically on board there. And the Belt and Road Initiative is President Xi's most ambitious foreign policy project at present. So that represented a major win for Xi. And then they also announced that Xi Jinping is planning to visit the Philippines in November of this year. So it was a very fruitful visit for China-Philippines relations. And really, this is only the latest of many indications showing that Mr. Duterte is rapidly shifting the Philippines toward closer relations with China.
And away from the United States, the Philippines, really one of the strongest and most enduring American alliances in the region, and this really has to come at the expense of its alliance with America.
That's exactly right. For decades, the Philippines has been one of America's most loyal allies. But President Duterte has really made no effort to conceal how eager he is to move the Philippines away from the United States. Ever since he's taken office back in 2016, he's made many moves toward that end. He canceled some joint Philippine-U.S. patrols, whose purpose was to monitor Chinese ships near the Philippines' territorial waters. He's also canceled some joint military exercises with the U.S. And at one point, Duterte even announced what he called his nation's separation from the United States and its realignment with Russia and China. He did later end up sort of softening those statements under pressure from high-ranking Philippine military officials. But it's clear that if it were up to Duterte, he would move the Philippines away from its traditional reliance on its treaty ally, the United States, and toward China.
So it's exactly what we've expected. And we've talked a lot about just this rise in China at America's expense. Put it in context, biblical prophecy-wise, for us.
Sure, yeah. In the first half, we discussed the Bible prophecies that talk about a massive Asian army that will be formed in the end time. And the book of Revelation says that this Asian army will have 200 million soldiers, which is just a really shocking number. Prophecy also shows that it'll be a block of multiple Asian nations, so not just one country. And then scriptures show that Russia will be the head country of this block, but that China will be in a secondary leadership role. So when we see the Philippines moving away from the U.S. and rallying behind China, you can see how that is laying the groundwork for this this Asian army prophecy to be fulfilled.
Well, we have an article that you can check out online. Will America's Asian allies pivot to China? That and all of the articles that we have talked about and booklets that we're pointing you to, you can just go to thetrumpet.com to the Trumpet Hour Hub and look for this program, and you can get links to all of that information in order to better inform yourself about these prophecies. As China pries America's Asian allies away, it's also engaged in massive thievery of American technology. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, on Wednesday, the Axe had several security experts testify before Congress warning of the threat to America posed by the theft of classified technology by Chinese scientists and researchers, and in some cases even professors, sending American tech back to the Chinese government for further analysis. Michelle Van Cleave, who's a former national counterintelligence executive, warned that China has a government-directed, multifaceted secret program whose primary task is technology acquisition, as well as a highly refined strategy to develop and exploit access to advantageous information through global telecommunications infrastructure. And some of the other experts had warned that specifically looking for like information on robotics, artificial intelligence, things like that that could be used for like next generation weaponry on the part of the Chinese military. And then there's a older report we even have on the article that's going to be going up on thetrumpet.com mentioning that, according to at least one Chinese dissident, they thought they had 25,000 actual Chinese intelligence officers in the United States, in addition to some of the students they collaborate with. And then this is something that's obviously been going on for some time and is kind of escalating now, but in the article it just makes a point that there's this prophecy we've highlighted before in Micah 5 about how God will cut off the military power of end time Israel just as it reaches its zenith, and then throw down the strongholds because of the sins of the people. And so this is something that kind of highlighted in the fact that especially something like industrial or military espionage like this is a way that other nations can keep pace with the newest technologies, adding their own changes to that could even come up with like game breaking things that really could make that prophecy seem much more realistic, how a military as big as the United States could actually come crashing down when you've got new technological breakthroughs that other nations are becoming very competitive at, partially through thievery like this.
Well, thanks very much for that, Andrew. We will leave it there. I'm Joel Hilliker. That's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com for links to the articles and literature we discussed today. You can email us your feedback at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Thanks for having me.
Good to be here.
It's been a pleasure.
Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Lloyd Jones. The men who try to do something and fail are infinitely better than those who try to do nothing and succeed. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.